from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
As the nation and the world continue to grapple with the questions of gender ideology, bishops are coming forward and delivering us very clear teachings on what the church believes and what we need to know about the human person. This week on Register Radio, we have the privilege of being joined by Toledo Bishop Daniel Thomas, who is going to discuss his very important pastoral letter on gender. And then Register senior contributor Edward Penton talks about the reaction to Charlie Kirk's assassination in the United Kingdom, and he gives some updates on notable stories across the pond. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, joined as always by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. How are you, Shannon?
I'm well, thank you, Matthew.
Well, as I was just mentioning, the question of gender ideology is something that has really emerged in the last decades. Pope Francis considered it to be of immense importance to the positioning of the human person in the modern world, anchoring, as he did, so much of our teaching in authentic understanding of human sexuality and also Catholic social teaching. Well, very happily, Bishop Daniel Thomas of Toledo, Ohio, has weighed in with a pastoral letter called The Body Reveals the Person, a Catholic Response to the Challenges of Gender Ideology. He joins us now. Your Excellency, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. Greetings, Matthew and Shannon, and so grateful to have this opportunity to talk about such a significant topic.
Well, exactly right in the sense of the significance of it. What was it that spurred you to draft this document?
You know, early on, I had been speaking to folks from around my diocese and beyond, and what really struck me were the uncertainties that are so prevalent when this topic comes up, and the concerns that the culture has so radically shifted that folks really just needed to hear what does the church teach? How does she care for folks who are struggling? How does she address parents and family members of folks who are struggling? And frankly, how can we sort of distill down into a briefer document what the church teaches and how we can really address it? So that was the effort. And in fact, at the end of the document, I simply said, I hope that folks will find in it the clear doctrinal emphasis, insightful scientific data, and a foundational pastoral approach. So really, those are the three things, because often our dear good folks simply don't even know the facts scientifically. Mm-hmm. And to try to make both readable and accessible, the church's teaching, for example, on the body, on dualism, on anthropology, these are not simple topics, but the effort was to make it accessible and readable.
Yes, it's not simple, but the way you've distilled it is really impressive and striking to many of us who have read different documents on this important subject. But it's by no means a brief document. It's over 7,000, nearly 8,000 words long. It has 41 endnotes.
right.
So I'm just as an editor, a writer and an editor, how long did it take this project to come together, and who else helped you?
Well, I think anybody knows that, no man is an island, as they say. And so no bishop is an island. And I obviously depend on great folks who are both assistants in writing, editing, producing the document, choosing the art, formatting, all of that took, a document like this just doesn't turn around. So months and months of work, obviously.
Yeah, Your Excellency, one of the questions that is often asked is, how did we end up here? How is it possible that we even need this type of, albeit very important, restatement and clarification of what the church actually teaches? What have you seen in your years as a pastor, as a priest, and now as a bishop that has changed in society?
Well, I think there are probably several things that we could point to, but certainly I would say the sexual revolution is significant in this regard. I would certainly say, the whole a debate about contraception, even under Paul VI, you know, who held very seriously the church's teaching. And then I would say the complete misunderstanding of what began some time ago and was the genius of St. John Paul II to address, you know, in his Theology of the Body. And it's extraordinary how that now is seen as even more prophetic, given where we find ourselves today. So I think all of those things, certainly the breakdown of the family, the rise of the extraordinary impact of social media and the devices that young people use, I think all of those things have certainly contributed to where we are today, including the whole question of marriage, because who could have imagined? I have people say to me all the time, Bishop, I couldn't have imagined that the definition of marriage between a man and woman not only would have been challenged, but would have been changed in law.
Your Excellency, the core of this document is the concept of unitive anthropology, which posits that the human person is a unity of both body and soul. Today, how can Catholics communicate that understanding in a culture that increasingly views gender as something fluid?
Right. I think really at the core of this is this whole question of whether or not there is objective reality and truth, and whether or not we base everything on feeling. So, you know, that unitive anthropology is that the body and soul are truly one, and that they are not to be separated. You know, so often I think we think of ourselves as bodies, but not as united to the soul. So the fact that God loves the person, that's why, you know, the title was landed on as the body reveals the person. Because I think in one of the things I comment, you know, when someone falls off a bicycle, they say, oh, I hurt myself. They don't say, oh, I damaged my body. So even analogously, even in our own language, we don't, you know, we say these things that are really reflective of the unity of body and soul. And of course, the church teaches this unity. And in fact, you know, we know that unity has an infinite value because of the understanding of the resurrection of the body. So even if the body has its finality physically and is separated for a time from the soul, our belief is that the body and soul will be reunited. And, you know, you can probably both understand that in doing a document like this, it's not just the text, but it was also the images that went with the text to reflect mm-hmm. that text. So, for example, the very, very last choice of art is the transfiguration of Jesus. And the transfiguration, the final lines of Jesus, you know, touching the apostles, rise and do not be afraid. So the fact that Jesus himself redeemed humanity in a human body, we cannot take that lightly. And as Catholics, of course, we don't.
Now, Your Excellency, you also go back to some very ancient ideas, dualism, with a very important focus on that. We can see elements, as you note, of Plato here. As I was reading this, I was reminded of the Gnostics, of the Manichaeans. Can you talk about the importance of why you put in dualism and its relationship to, as you write, the ethics of human life and sexuality?
Right. I think this dualist anthropology, as I wrote, denies the personal value of the human body and regards it simply as material to be manipulated, and therefore fails to see the personal significance even of the body's sexed nature. So it's not difficult to see that this dualist anthropology, if you can consider these things separate, the reality is then that it can justify other offenses to life, for example, abortion and euthanasia. So if someone is not, quote, capable of work, well, then there's no reason why they need to be valued. And we would say, of course, this is absolutely incorrect, because we value the person no matter what they can or cannot do. They matter intrinsically because they're created as a body-soul unity in the image of God. And so I think, again, the work there was to distill, you know, in a very, very simple and tight manner, this reality of dualism. But I must share with you that some of the reaction it's gotten is that was a most significant part of the letter.
Your Excellency, what practical steps or suggestions do you have for parents who are helping young people navigate issues of gender identity?
Thank you. So if I could just share with you two pastoral moments I had as I was about to publish this document, and as I did publish it, I had one father who I simply asked how he was doing, and he asked me what I was working on, and I told him about this document, and this father just simply began to cry and talk about his young adult son who is considering transitioning. And we spoke, you know, about his own pain, the pain that his son is suffering. And in addition, and completely separate, there was a woman who shared with me, she read the document just after its publication, and her son is considering transitioning, in quotes, of course. And she sent the document to the son. The son called her, and they had a lengthy conversation about it, where he was very, very open to speaking of it and to speaking of how he might share with her this Catholic understanding. So I think the first, of course, is love. And all that we do has to be in love. But, you know, it's that classic line, sharing the truth in charity. So that we first have to love and accompany people, find them where they are, and we have to be able to reach out to them to indicate that they are loved by God, that God desires their goodness and their happiness, and that God also desires them to see their own bodies and to recognize their own persons as loved first by Him. And if they can begin to see that, then hopefully, please God, that can change hearts.
Well, Your Excellency, thank you again for the time, but also thank you for this pastoral letter. I think this is something of a must read, especially for young people who might be facing issues like gender dysphoria or the influence of what we're seeing in social media, and also for parents. So where can people find your pastoral letter?
Thank you so much. So it's available at www.toledodiocese.org under news. And I can share with you, some people have written to us and asked for copies of it. We're not doing it as a publication. We simply invite people to download it themselves and to utilize it that way.
Yeah, you have a very handy version that can be printed, so thank you for that, too.
Sure, and there's also a version, as you probably know already, that can actually be read, you know, typically like a magazine as well.
Yeah. Well, as I said, this is an absolute must read for Catholics and people of good conscience. Bishop Daniel Thomas, thank you so much again.
A blessing, and I pray God that it might serve our church and all those who are suffering, affected by, or in any way touched by this issue. Thank you so much. Well, blessings.
God bless you. Well, when we come back, we're going to be joined by Edward Penton, Register Senior Contributor, with reports of the news from the United Kingdom, including reaction to the murder of Charlie Kirk. This is Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Please come back.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, your host, along with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief for the National Catholic Register. Continuing our programming this week, as we take a moment now to bring in Edward Penton, Register Senior Contributor, who has followed the assassination, the murder of Charlie Kirk, and the reaction to it across the pond, so to speak. Edward, welcome.
Hi, Matthew. Good to be with you.
Well, first, thank you for joining us. There are some other stories that I know we also want to get to, including the passing of the Duchess of Kent. But let's start with the murder of Charlie Kirk. What's the reaction been in the United Kingdom?
Well, it's been he's not obviously as well known over here as he is over there, but he has become quite a sort of celebrity figure in the past few months because he gave speeches, two addresses to the unions of Cambridge and Oxford, and that's always a very sort of prestigious event, and they get various well-known figures to come over and talk to the students, and then the students can ask them questions. It's quite an old ancient tradition, and he wrote about that in The Spectator after he'd done it in May, and it was quite interesting to see his views about what happened and his takes on the students in Britain compared to the United States. And his main point was that in many ways the students were behind the students in the United States, which was a surprise to him, because they hadn't really understood, if you like, the sort of revolution that's been going on in terms of returning to sort of more traditional values, which is something that hasn't really caught on yet. It has started to, but in a very small way, over in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, that piece that you're referring, that was in The Spectator. He talks about this kind of the perception of the UK as being 10, 15 years ahead of us, and people were seeing the deepening secularization, progressiveness. And thinking not too long ago that we were looking at the future of the United States, and then Trump happened, you know, and that has really flipped the script, so to speak, where, and not just in the UK, but in other countries in Europe where it was going a certain way, and now this kind of latent fledgling return to faith. Return to traditional values, return in a sense to a brand of conservatism is mm-hmm. happening. But, you know, one of the things I think is so interesting, you're seeing that in the UK. You've written about this, Edward, about the young men kind of leading the charge. And I know that was part of Charlie Kirk's core audience here in the United States was young men. What are you seeing with young men? What's happening with young men in the UK right now?
Well, it's interesting because he makes a distinction between towards the end of his piece about how, yes, there is that element in academia in Britain where they still very much sort of have a liberal progressive slant, a very ideological positions. But actually, he said, you know, when you go into the streets and just the average man on the street, he said that they tend to get it more. And they tend to understand the situation in much sort of clearer way, more akin to those in the United States than in Oxford and Cambridge, which is an interesting observation that you'd think that in the sort of the leading academic institution in the country, that they would have their finger on the pulse more. But his perception was the other way around. And he said they're really sort of playing catch up with the youth in the United States and the sort of man on the street in Britain. And that's certainly something that one's seen. And the young men in particular who are being attracted to the faith and to tradition, you get that in the country, but not in those sort of high echelons of academia and in stuck in sort of ivory towers. So yes, that was a very interesting observation and I think very much an accurate one from what one can see.
Yeah, so looking at it from that perspective, what has been the reaction of the upper echelons to Charlie Kirk's assassination? I mean, certainly how has the British media responded to it?
Yes, it's often couched in the sort of, you know, it's very sad, obviously tragic what's happened. But, you know, he did sort of, you know, his rhetoric was very inflammatory. And so, you know, there's always couched in those terms. It's at least in the mainstream media, but not many. That doesn't really carry much weight these days. And you know, increasingly people are looking to alternative media, and they have that obviously has a completely different view, more sort of, many would say, a more accurate view of what's actually happened and what the situation is. So that's the general reaction. But I heard from actually a relative who I didn't think was actually interested in sort of Charlie Kirk, and he really paid tribute to him. He's not really on the same political wing as him, but he said he was very sad about it, found him very articulate, and thought it was absolutely tragic. So you know, people, even if they aren't of his view, are still very struck by it and see it as a great loss.
Yeah, you've been covering a lot of news out of the UK, and a lot of it is bad, right? Passage of assisted suicide bill, the decriminalization of abortion, and other things that are going on there. But what you've also brought to the pages of the Register is these other signs of hope, other interesting things that are happening in the Catholic space. Just in recent days, you wrote about the Duchess of Kent's death. She was a Catholic convert, has a very interesting story. And then this past weekend, you went to the March for Life in London, which seemed to be very well attended. Edward, what was the scene there like?
Yes, it really was quite a great success. I think the organizers were very happy with it, and it drew a lot of people to it. It was the first one I'd been to. I'd been to the Rome ones many times, but what I noticed about this one was the variety, the diversity of the people, and the different denominations, and it was really very much a sort of unified carnival sort of atmosphere, and very much I think, yes, yeah, seen as a great success. And I think and also what I noticed is the opposition they got, that is something I didn't see in Rome. You know, they got quite a few protesters. Now, whether that's a good sign, I don't know, but it was certainly something that one could see, because it shows that they're sort of making inroads. And I think there was also seven bishops attending, seven Catholic bishops, and other religious leaders as well. And so it was very much, as I say, a very diversified, unified celebration of life, really. It was really a very, very good atmosphere. Lots of young people, lots of families. And yes, I think in many ways you could argue that it's perhaps a sign of hope in the country, despite all these dark and gloomy bits of news and very, very negative bits of news. I think it's possibly a reaction to that too, because I think people are beginning to wake up to the fact that these inroads against life seem to be getting more and more, and there needs to be a reaction against it. And people are starting to, I think, to possibly wake up to that. As I said earlier, as we talked earlier about the young men being attracted to the Catholic faith, but not just the Catholic faith, but to Christianity in general, I think is also speaks to that too, and that sort of a reaction, if you like, to these rather dark times in the country.
Yeah, and we can't let you go without at least discussing the visit of King Charles III to the Birmingham Oratory. What is the significance of that, and the funeral also of the Duchess of Kent?
Yes, it was interesting that those two came very much in succession. I think the King going to the Birmingham Oratory was interesting in the sense that it was his wish to go and visit it. It wasn't something that was obviously they wanted him to visit, but it wasn't an invitation put out to him. It was something he was very interested to do. So that interest in Catholicism from the King, I think, surprised some people, and especially in Cardinal Newman as well. And then we have the death of the Duchess of Kent, who was a much loved figure, very much loved for her work in charitable work, but also just who she was. She was very graceful, kind, and very much a generous woman of faith. And she was, of course, a convert, the first senior royal to become a Catholic in 300 years. So that was very historic too, that she died. But again, it sort of points possibly to a general sort of return, or certainly a sort of the faith sort of coming back to British life in some way, in some very small way. But at least there's a sign there that perhaps the Catholic faith is sort of making inroads in a way that it hasn't before. And I think this is giving a lot of faithful, a lot of hope.
Is it something of an irony that Catholicism should be undergoing a bit of a renaissance or a real flowering in England at a time when England needs it most?
Yes, I think that's right, Matthew. I think as you know, the sun, the light shines brightly in the darkness, and it does seem as though the people are sort of seeing the light of the faith in this darkness, and at least that's the hope. Yeah. And so, yes, it does seem to be that case, that sort of phenomenon that's going on.
Well, Edward, thank you as always for your work and your reporting and your faith.
Thank you, Matthew. Good to be with you both.
Well, that's it this week for Register Radio. Remember, for more news, commentary, and analysis, go to ncregister.com. On behalf of Shannon Mullen and our producer, Michael McCall, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please, until next week, take care and God bless.